Okay, so folks, we're here now with, of all people, Pauline Butcher, Frank's secretary during the classic Mothers of Invention era in the late 60s and early 70s. Hello, Pauline.
Hi.
We're here. We're all here now. Thank you very much for doing the show with us. Your book is Freak Out, My Life with Frank Zappa, and it's I'm fairly certain that most people who listen to our show would already have the book, but if you do not have the book, it is probably the best account I have ever read of that era, which is, certainly my, I suppose, favorite era of Frank's life and music, and probably a lot of other people's as well. So just very happy, very, very happy to have you on the show.
I agree that if people out there haven't got the book, they really need to go out and get it. It's a wonderful book, very well written. And thanks, Pauline, for doing that. We just wanted to talk a little bit about the book, bring out some of the stories in there. We're looking in this episode of the podcast at the Vaudeville Band era, the Flo and Eddie era, and around that time, you were working at Bizarre, and you were also editing the Groupie papers. Can you tell us a bit about the Groupie papers that you were working on?
Well, I started working on the Groupie papers, thankfully, because my job was running a bit thin when Frank didn't write his political book, which he was supposed to write, and the reason why I went out there to work for him in the first place. So when he didn't get around to writing it, there was a hole in my job. And thankfully, it was filled by Frank asking me to type up Cynthia Plastercaster's diary and Pamela Miller's diary. Pamela was one of the GTOs, and she was a singer and songwriter. But Cynthia Plastercaster had a slightly more checkered career with her plastercasting the penises of pop stars and rock stars and actors of the time. And she has some wonderful drawings, which are superb. And she kindly gave me one to put in my book, which I love, of her failed attempt on one of the Procol Harum to cast his private member. And so she describes all of that in her diaries, and they started from when they were about 16, and I typed all of those up, and they were actually 900 pages in all. Took me 2 months. And then I suggested to Frank that they were a little long, and could I edit them? And he, in his wonderful way, which was what made working for him so wonderful, was he always gave me credit to do whatever I wanted to do. He allowed you to excel in any way you wanted. He always encouraged that. So I said I would like to edit them. I think I can do it by bringing, instead of doing it in chronological order from when I was 16 through to 21 or whatever it was, bring all the stuff about Noel Redding together, bring all the stuff about Mick Jagger together, and so on, and make it a more interesting piece. And he agreed, and I did spend the next 2 months doing that, night and day, trying to get that together. Then that brought them down to about 300 pages, and they sent them off, but nothing actually happened, because really they were a bit ragged even then. They were a bit ragged, but Pamela did her own version of them, much, much better than I did with that, much better. What's it called? I'm with the Band.
With the Band, yeah. Another good book. You mentioned Noel Redding there, who of course was one of the cast, and also he'd written some diaries, and Frank, you got hold of those, didn't you?
Yes, well, when I came back to England because of ill health, he suggested that I could carry on working for him by typing up the diaries of Redding, and I went down to his house, his mother's house at Dymchurch, and collected them, and came back and typed them up, but they were mostly two-word sentences, really. Got up, had a bath, had breakfast, the Band broke down, had got stoned, or something like that. They weren't very detailed. So when I told Frank about this, that they weren't very detailed, when he came over to London, he again, with his wonderful way, said to me, well, write yourself as a character in the book and make something of it that way. And I never stopped, you know, feeling so pleased with him, because he was the only person that believed in the fact that I could be a writer and I should be a writer.
So did he actually ask you to pretend that you were Noel Redding and write his diaries or another whole character?
No, what it was, see, Noel Redding's diaries were going to become part of the group of papers, so they were all going to be joined together. And then he said, make myself a person in the groupie papers and write it as if I'm writing a letter to Frank.
Yeah.
Do it that way and use the diaries and mould them around me. But in fact, the task was beyond me. It really was.
So it was almost like doing a fantasy thing, write whatever you like.
Yeah, well, no, use the diaries. Use the diaries. Put myself as a character, which is also rather gravitating. Put myself as a character into the books.
Pauline, on this episode of the Zappacast, what we're doing is we're talking about the Flo and Eddie / vaudeville era of the Mothers. And I know that you saw Frank in the period immediately following his accident at the Rainbow in London. You actually visited with him in the hospital, and that is detailed in your book. And we wanted to ask you a little bit about your recollections of that period, particularly whether or not Frank was potentially planning on hanging up the Flo and Eddie era Mothers, if he had had enough, even maybe even prior to the accident, or if he was still having a good time and wanted to continue it. What do you think, Andrew?
He seemed to really enjoy that period. So, yeah, I don't think there was any plans to split the band up. But it's interesting that, you know, after the accident, he did have a complete change in direction with the sort of big bands and jazz things.
Well, I mean, if you talk to Mark about it, I think it's well documented, is it not, that they had to sit around not knowing what was going to happen, and they had to go and get themselves other employment because Frank wasn't able to pay them while he was sitting in a wheelchair for all that time. So by the time Frank was ready to go back, they themselves were not willing to pick up again with Frank, as I understand it. I mean, I think the story is picked up more easily at the other end of Frank's recuperation period, when that is when it gets picked up. And I was under the impression, through that early period of his recovery, that he was still expecting to pick up with that band again, but they themselves went off in other directions, inevitably, I suppose.
One of the guys that carried on working with Frank is Ian Underwood. Did you talk about your relationships with the bands? Ian Underwood was obviously a key friend during that period as well.
He was a key friend to me.
Yes.
Yes, he was, yes. I was totally besotted with him. And but for his love for Ruth, I think I would have got involved with him, but he was so in love with her, and that there was no question. So, in fact, we had a very close relationship, which was protected by his feelings for Ruth. So we could spend hours together, we, you know, hang out like close buddies.
Yeah.
And that was very gratifying, very, very nice. Mm.
Do you have any contact with Ian these days?
I've tried to, but he's actually hidden himself away and he doesn't want any contact, I don't think. I think he's living in Portland. I wrote to him when I was writing the book because I wanted to ask everybody I was writing about to say, look, this is what I'm writing. Yeah. I'll send you what I'm writing about you.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to get hold of him, and I couldn't get hold of Ruth either. And apart from Dale, everyone else I did.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you mentioned that you tried to contact Ruth and you felt bad that you hadn't actually been able to get hold of her before the book was published. But again, yeah, I don't think she comes out of it badly at all.
Oh, no.
No, I think you've been very fair with everybody. So.
I hope so. I mean, I would like to hear from her, frankly. I mean, I would really like to hear from her, but the silence is ominous, you know, it's strange.
No.
I mean, I've got stuff on Dweezil's website talking about my book. So, is it Dweezil's website or the Zappa website?
All of them, I think.
Well, yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen all of them. But so she must know about it.
Well, I don't know. She's kept a very low profile for years, hasn't she? She's out every now and again. But, we don't hear too much from her at all. So I wouldn't take it as an anonymous sign by any means.
But, I mean, it must be good for Frank as well, because I'm exposing him to all sorts of people that wouldn't normally know about him anymore.
Yeah.
You know, younger generation even. I've been talking to people in Singapore here, and they've always said to me, "Oh, well, I must listen to his music," when I've told them about my book.
Yeah, that's it. I agree. You know, anything like a book or things that Scott and I are doing here and the websites and everything else, it's all helps to promote Frank, so it's all to the good.
I hope so. Okay,
we touched on there the accident at the Rainbow, and you said you were more involved in Frank's personal life. At that time, there was a character Nigel Lennon describes as Miss Moviola, who I didn't know who that was until I read your books, a lady called Karen Sperling. So Frank...
Yes.
Involved with her. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know that there wasn't a tremendous amount of interaction, but you can tell us a little bit about Karen.
Well, when Frank was in London on that last end of the Mothers of Invention, the very first Mothers of Invention tour, I saw him several times, and he introduced me to his girlfriend, Karen Sperling, who was from New York, very attractive young filmmaker who'd made a most interesting film herself. I've forgotten the name of it offhand, I should have looked that up. But anyway, Make a Face or something with face in the title. And Frank seemed to be very keen for me to be friends with her. And I did when he went back off on tour around Europe, and while he was away, I went to see her several times and hung out with her friends and watched her film. And when Frank came back, this was before the being knocked off the stage, but after the fire, in between there, we went out to dinner one night. She was all of this idea that she and Frank would be like John and Yoko and would make films together and make music together and they were the new union thing. But I saw the first signs that night of his withdrawing a bit from her, and he seemed more keen to talk to me across the table than he was to her hanging around his neck all evening. So I don't know. He was obviously quite keen. But I think maybe she was a bit too keen. And then when, of course, he got knocked off the stage, she was there in London, so she was at his bedside when he was first in hospital. And Hurley said, don't worry about it. Karen's at the bedside, but don't worry. Gail's on her way, with his wry humour, as he said. And then, of course, there was a Mickey, sort of hide-and-seek game with Herbie pushing Karen in to see Frank in between Gail's visits, but gradually Karen got the message, and I think she went back to New York, yeah. And Gail was there on her own.
I think she only ever made one other film after Make a Face, and then just dropped off the radar.
I think she did, yes. I tried to find her too. I mean, it's possible that she's not even
with us
anymore, I suppose, but it's not a terribly common name.
No, I found an artist by the name of Karen Sperling, but maybe if you say she was a sort of Yoko sort, maybe she did go off and buy some Jersey cows and start painting, who knows?
Oh, well, maybe that's who she is, because there is a Karen Sperling artist on the website, so maybe that's who she is.
I'll maybe write to her and find out.
Yes, maybe. It would be quite interesting to get her take on... What I've written about her, oh dear. But she has, some interesting stories to tell.
Yeah, she would have.
I suppose, if people are interested in Frank outside of his music.
I think it's like anything, isn't it? It's always, if people like someone's work, whatever it is, whether be it films, books, whatever, there's always an interest in, what's behind that person and how the stories, how the art came to be,
Yeah.
One of the other characters, of course, is Pamela Zarubica. Did you know she lives in London now? She's ever since she left Frank. Were you aware of that?
I saw her just about 4 days before I came to Singapore. We had an interesting evening together.
That was recently, you mean? Were you publicising the book or before you moved to Singapore?
At that point, I wasn't writing the book. I was doing it as a play. And it wasn't until I got to Singapore that I turned it into a book. It was originally going to be a play for radio or on the stage, either way. And I just envisaged that as the log cabin, and the whole thing would be condensed into the log cabin period.
Yeah.
Which, in fact, my book is mostly about the log cabin anyway.
So is that something that you might still pick up?
I would like to. I'm talking to someone at the radio, BBC Radio 4.
Yeah.
With a producer, and I'm just working on the treatment of it, but I haven't had much time because I've been so busy with all this kind of thing with the book still. But yes, certainly I would very much like to pick that up if I can. She is now working as some kind of
cat therapist.
Alternative therapy person.
Yeah.
She has alternative therapy.
A website.
She has a website. But obviously my relationship with her was just as peculiar as my relationship with Gail. And I think part of the interest in my book anyway, as far as I'm concerned, is, and some people have said it's a very girly book, is the fact that I not only talk about Frank and the mothers, but I also talk about all these women that were around Frank. And it seemed like the book is all about Frank Zappa's women, but the publisher didn't want to call it that. They didn't think that would work.
That's good, because I've been approached about writing a book about Frank Zappa's women, so...
Oh, my goodness. Oh, well. There you go. There you are.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll ever happen.
There's
quite a lot of it. So you'll have about 900 pages, I should think.
Yeah. And it would be very nice to have Gail involved as well, but I think the chances are very slim.
Well, she always wanted to write that book, you know, encouraged by Frank about all the groupies he knew. This most bizarre thing, and she wanted to interview me as well. And I said, well, I didn't sleep with Frank, and we had this big scene, which I'm not going to describe now. You'll have to read the book to find out.
Yes, I'm reading it now. My copy actually just got here recently, so halfway through it, it's just the most amazing, I think, account that I've ever read of that time, because, you know, there are other books. I was going to ask you about David Wally, who had written the No Commercial Potential book, right? Have you read very many books about Frank?
Yes, I have. I've read them all. I think there's one that escaped, but I've read them all, including all the music critiques. And I meant to bring those out here because I wanted to mention to you which ones I really like. But I thought they all did a really good job, in fact. Maybe the first one, no Commercial Potential, is a bit thin on the ground because he didn't actually have enough material. But I thought Barry Meyer's book is superb. I thought it was a first-class piece of work.
Have you read Ben Watson's book?
I have. I couldn't cope with it, really. It was far too much for me. I prefer the other one. No, I haven't. It's outside the room. I can't go and get it. But the other one that was written, very similar style, but about the music. What's it written by? A name that reads like a girl, but I think it's a man.
Kelly Lo Fisher.
Yes, that's it. I like that one. I think it's very good. What's your take?
On Ben Watson's book, I know Ben very well. But I have difficulty with it. Ben read him extracts from it. You know, Frank was rolling about on the floor laughing, really.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I wrote a review of it on Amazon and said that, you know, if it could be simplified so I could understand it. I'd appreciate it, but, you know, it's too complicated, too difficult for me.
Yeah, the sort of parallels he draws with Finnegan's Wake and things are all just more coincidence than anything else. You know, Ben thinks there's a lot more to it than that.
Oh, no, I don't think it's very, you know, it's sort of more, you know, Frank's work is sort of more steeped in American culture, I tend to think, than any, you know, sort of Finnegan's Wake type of stuff, I think. But it's a very funny read. If only it were written in English, as I like to say. Pauline, you got to interview Frank in 1988. And what were your sort of impressions? Did you have any sense? I mean, you sort of hint in the book that you had maybe a sense that he was not entirely well, if not sick per se, but... what were your impressions of him during that conversation? Because I know you confronted him about his sort of groupie dalliances and that sort of thing. But do you have any impressions that you'd care to share with him about him in those sort of final years?
Well, as I say, I just saw him once in 1988 when I went to his hotel, which was in April. So Andrew will know that that was, what, about halfway through that last tour, yeah. Was it?
Just before.
Yeah, about halfway through. And I saw him in this huge, great room he was sitting in. And it was all very dour, and it was a dull day, and it was cold, and it just, and he looked very somber. He wasn't his usual wry self, and he looked rather drawn, I thought. And the main thing I noticed was that he coughed on every sentence. I've got a tape recording of it. And every sentence, you know, to broadcast it, you had to take all these coughs out. And I just thought that he was fired from the touring. I thought he was probably, he was 49, I think, then, or was he? I said to him, you know, you're 1 year away from 50, halfway to 100, as if that was anything to anything, but... And how did you find the touring? Was it tiring? Because I picked up that he obviously thought it was tiring, but there was no way that I could possibly say I thought he was seriously ill. No, I did not. He looked worn. He looked tired. He was below par. But by the time I finished the interview, he really perked up. He was really his old self at the end of it.
Yeah, I read the last question you asked him.
Well, I mean, he had perked up towards the end of the interview, and so at the end I said to him, I've got one last question, do you have anything you'd like to ask me? And he paused and thought for a minute, and then he said, not on the tape.
With a twinkle in his eye.
But actually he did go on to ask me a question which I've written about in the book, but I that was his move, so you can see that he'd obviously chirped up towards the end. I have one quite precious memento of Frank's, which is a lock of his hair, which he gave me, paradoxically, while he was sitting in his bathroom and Gail was cutting his hair, and it all fell great dollops onto the floor, a huge amount of hair. It's very long, and she cut it quite short. And I had this heavy discussion about women's love, and there was me standing up there and saying, I think, you know, women have a right to be equal to men and all this business and stand on their own 2 feet and be independent. And he was cajoling me and not having any of it. And then I ridiculously finished the whole thing by saying to him, may I have a lock of your hair? And I took it home and pasted it in my diary. So it was a bit of a paradox there. But I kept it, and I still have it, and I opened it to look at it and to photograph it, to put on Facebook, and I left the page open, and our cat came along and thought it was a toy.
Oh, no.
Started playing with it and pulled it to pieces. Well, not completely to pieces, but I caught her before she shredded the whole thing, but I did have to lovingly curl it back into place again.
Regular listeners to the Zeppercast will know that I occasionally have trouble with my cats as well.
That's right. They're almost a part of the show.
Not today.
I've got a photograph of it on my Facebook page.
Okay, well, I think we've got some more stuff there, Scott, don't you?
I think we got a fair amount, yes.
Yeah, got some good stuff.
All right, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate giving me the time.
Oh, well, thank you very much. We're very honored to have you on the show. So, you know, I'm just honored beyond words to have you on our show, Pauline.
Oh, wow, I can't believe it. I don't know whether you've got... You have a lovely voice, by the way, Scott.
And, oh, thank you very
much. As all Americans do, don't they, Andrew? They always have this lovely drawl.
Yeah, they do.
And then I hear my voice, and I think, oh, my God. But hopefully it's clear, so I hope that gets away in a bit. So far, so far.
Okay, pin back your lugholes, diamond geezers and pearly queens. It's the Idiot Bastard here with the news roundup, and we have loads to get through. Starting off with some book news, Don Preston has recently published a book of poems and stories called Listen, A Thought Faster Than Light. In January, Hal Leonard is issuing another in its series of Zappa album transcription books. This time, it's one size fits all. You've just heard Frank's former secretary, Pauline Butcher, talking about her excellent new book, Freak Out My Life with Frank Zappa. Well, she has very kindly also written an afterword for the paperback version of my own book, Zappa the Hard Way, which is out on the 21st of November. It's awesome. Her afterward days. Oh, yeah, obviously in my book. Mike Keneally has recorded keyboards on four tunes for the new Chickenfoot album. That's the American supergroup comprising former Van Halen members Sammy Hagar and Michael Anthony, Red Hot Chili Pepper Chad Smith and Joe Satriani. Mike will also be featured on Satch's Live in Montreal CD-DVD soon. Mike appeared as a special guest on a new live download-only album by Robert Fripp, recorded during one of the shows from the 97 G3 tour. And Mike's next album, under his own name, will be Wing Beat Fantastic. It's centred around the material he co-wrote with Andy Partridge, and I, for one, can't wait to hear it. Because I like Mike. A lot. Ensemble Moderne appear on a disc called Continent Verez, where they perform some of the stuff that will one day see the light on The Rage and the Fury, we hope. Tom Fowler has a new album out, Let's Start Over. It features his brother Walt, Mike Miller, and the wondrous vocals of one Andrea Miller. Tom will be touring Europe next year as part of the Grandmothers, what with Roy Estrada not being available for the foreseeable. Another former Z bassist, little Paddy O'Hearn, has a new album called Reaching Land, out any day soon. The George Duke Band have their Live in Prague DVD out. It features a tribute to Frank, and in November, the George Duke Quartet are touring Europe, including two dates at London's Jazz Cafe, and I'll be there. Crossfire Publications has just issued Candy Zappers To Be Perfectly Frank. This is a download album. And they've also issued her husband Nolan Porter's first album. Sorry, her husband Nolan Porter's first two albums, with oodles of bonus tracks. The backing band for half of the tracks on No Apologies consisted of Jimmy Carl Black, Roy Estrada, Lowell George, and when Jimmy left to form Geronimo Black, he got drummer Richie Hayward and keyboardist Bill Payne to replace him. So essentially he had the Little Feet Boys there. The follow-up, simply called Nolan, includes the Northern Soul classic If I Could Only Be Sure, featuring Johnny Guitar Watson. Really good song, that. Other musicians on that album include Jim Gordon and Larry Carlton. Griffin Labs, who are basically the Zappa Play Zappa band with Rick Masalem on guitar instead of Dweezil, are offering a free album download called The Red Room. You've got to be mad not to grab it. Adrian Belew's E for Orchestra is now available as a studio version CD and a live DVD. It rocks. While we await iTunes number 8, Steve is featured on classical guitarist Sharon Isbin's new release, Guitar Passions. The Bunk Gardener story, part 1 from Zonic Entertainment, is now available to download. This and part 2, which follows shortly, also featured Don Preston. There's another new album, The Doug Lunn Project, featuring Vinnie Carliuta on all tracks, plus Mr. Keneally on one. And Vinnie is about to hit the road with Mr. Sting again. In September, the Zappa Family Trust released Feeding the Monkeys at Marmason, the recently discovered Synclavier album intended for final release by Frank that Gail mentioned at the Roundhouse last year. The Fireworks Ensemble have recorded an album of Zappa compositions called None of the Above. It will be available next spring and includes some previously unheard pieces, I am told. At the revamped Dweezil Zappa World website, DZ mentions a new double CD project titled Dweezil Zappa Live in the Moment, a shut-up-and-play-your-guitar-style compilation sporting a cover by Cal Schenkel. Sounds very interesting, that, and it may be available on a ZPZ's winter tour of the UK. And finally, imminently jumping out of the vault and biting your bum is a four-CD set from the two mother shows at Carnegie Hall in October 1971. How very apt. OK, that's it. If you want further info on any of this, visit idiotbastard.com. You know it makes sense.
Okay, and now on to some music here on this last part of our three-part look at the 1970 and 1971 vaudeville bands on the Zappacast. Frank and the Mothers headed for Europe in November of 1971 for their annual European trip and also to promote the release of 200 Motels, the film, and the soundtrack album. And one of the pieces that they performed on that tour was a piece that was somewhat similar to Billy the Mountain and incorporated segments that are known to us now as Once Upon a Time, Sofa, Stick It Out, and Divan.
and the entire suite went under the title of Divan. And Frank issued some of this material on the You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, Volume 1 album. He released the first couple of segments from the concert in London on December 10th of 1971. But here, from the infamous Fire concert at the Casino de Montreux in Montreux, Switzerland, on December 4th, 1971, is in its entirety Divan, right here on the Zappacast.
For those of you in the audience who happen to speak German, and if you do happen to speak German, after this speech, you'll probably regret it.
Stretching all the way from Mondu Central, up on top of the hill, right now to the front door of the Excelsior Hotel. And the Lord proceeded to deliver unto the sofa a brief lecture that would set forth in specific language the sum total of all of their future relationships, including options, with an electric clarinet.
Because we're going to make a home movie. host, Fabius
immense ecumenical bandana at the right hand of God's big rumba. And his voice pronounced out in sheets of plywood and bales of old sport shirts.
What does he say?
And he says, in the middle of his delirious stupor, the Klecker Nish.
Be Klecker Nish.
Be Klecker Nish.
Be Klecker Nish.
Fine sofa.
Obviously meaning, don't get no chiz on the sofa. It is now time for the bales of imported unmitigated zircon fondue.
Ballin fun zircon. Und auf dem Sporthemden Lachen von Juri von Blue Lachen von Tränen von
And of course, what self-respecting Zappacast would be complete without adding the actual end to that concert in Montreux? This is King Kong, which was the moment that the actual fire broke out, and fortunately for Zappaologists everywhere, the guy who was recording the tape left his tape running during the evacuation of the building. So here you are, King Kong and the fire in Montreux, Switzerland, December 4th, 1971, on the Zappacast.
Ja, hey, gib mir...
сейчас не приключишь. С ними твой восток. Я. Хочу ще п'ястою, там іди. Бере. Это ж мать сейка запали.
This is Nigel Lennon. I'm reading from the book Being Frank, My Time with Frank Zappa, now available as an ebook wherever fine ebooks are sold. The chapter I'm reading from is Positively 57th Street. Meanwhile, strange scenes were awaiting me when the tour reached New York. I had never been on the East Coast before, and I found the pressure cooker atmosphere of Manhattan to be overwhelming. Frank had roots in New York. He'd spent some of his most fruitful days in Greenwich Village, his spiritual home in some ways, as it had also been the headquarters for his idol, composer Edgard Varèse. And he had many friends who dated back to the Mother's long run at the Garrick Theater during the 60s. It was a milieu in which I had no place whatsoever. This was brought very forcibly to my attention when I learned that for the first time since I'd been with Frank, I had to cope with competition. The minute we had checked into the Holiday Inn on West 57th Street, the phone rang. Frank was in the living room, setting up the stereo he'd rented, so I answered it. There was a pronounced click as the caller hung up. A few minutes later, it rang again, and again I answered it. A throaty voice, tinged with laughter, asked to speak to Frank. "Who is this, please?" I asked icily. Right then, Frank waltzed in, glared at me, and snatched the phone out of my hand. Not too long afterward, a red-headed avant-garde filmmaker in her mid-20s appeared on the doorstep. She was excruciatingly sophisticated and confident, and Frank was plainly crazy about her. I wasn't. I moped sullenly about until Frank got fed up and called down to the front desk to inquire if they had another room for me. They didn't. I had to sleep on the sofa in the living room. There were two beds in the bedroom, but I couldn't stand being in there, and besides, I hadn't been invited. I think Frank actually felt a little guilty about the situation, but he was also annoyed that I was cramping his New York lifestyle. What bothered me the most was Miss Moviola's relaxed, comfortable way of dealing with Frank. Watching her made me feel and act a million times klutzier around him. I knew that this universe had existed before me, and I had the feeling it would be continuing long after I was only a few odd magnetic particles on Frank's master tape. As it turned out, I didn't see that much of Frank anyway. He was busy 36 hours a day, introducing the media to 200 motels, and engaging in vast quantities of glad-handing, premiere hosting, interview giving, and assorted publicity stunts. There was a great deal of interest in the movie, because it was the first feature-length film to be shot on video for budgetary reasons, and then bumped up to film for general release. Frank made a big point of dragging me to the premiere. He may have just been ensuring I wouldn't feel left out, but I think he also wanted me to see the film because of its subject, Life on the Road. Although I didn't feel like going, I dutifully attended the screening, but I was in such a scattered state mentally that the movie failed to leave much of an impression on me. Back in L.A. a few months later, I saw 200 Motels again, by myself, in a regular movie theater with a box of Milk Duds. Although it was easier to concentrate, knowing that the writer, composer, director wasn't sitting next to me in the dark, reading my mind, I still found the opus disjointed and formless, and wondered if that was because the whole thing was just over my head conceptually. In actuality, the original script had been much more linear, but the usual cinematic bugaboo, budgetary limitations, had made it impossible to film some crucial sections. The whole thing had been shot on a soundstage in London in a matter of weeks. Frank was obsessed with the idea of film, but if 200 Motels was any indication, it appeared that his vision was difficult to translate to the cinematic medium. Maybe to be an effective filmmaker, he needed more than sociological archetypes, musical contrasts, and documentation. At any rate, the juxtapositions that worked so well on record and in live performance seemed flat and labored, even a little boring, up on the screen. Luckily, I wasn't a film critic nor even a film buff, and I never would have expressed my reservations to the auteur. I figured it was safer to stick to music and leave the Fellini bit to Frank's Greenwich Village cineast chums. Frank may have envisioned himself as another Bunuel or Eisenstein, but when it came right down to it, his heart was still right there with Guitar Slim, and I was there with both of them, eternally prepared to bend some strings. Whatever charms Miss Moviola and her aesthetic may have possessed for him, she still couldn't jam all night on the blues with him like I could. To promote 200 Motels, Frank arranged a big bash for the band, the media, and a lot of his cronies at Sardi's, the famed showbiz watering hole. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go, but I went, and, I'm sorry to say, spent the evening trying to make Frank jealous by flirting shamelessly with the unfortunate band member who had the hots for me. Everybody, meanwhile, was engaging in pretty serious drinking. In my romantic affliction, I, too, yearned mightily for a slug from the cup that cheers, but I didn't dare order any alcohol. I'd already been carded a couple of times during the tour while attempting to obtain a drink in some podunk Holiday Inn cocktail lounge, and I was concerned that if I got nailed again here, in front of all these jaded sophisticates, not to mention her, I'd die of mortification. Little did I know that the legal drinking age in New York State was 18, not 21 the way it had been in California. The next day, Frank kept erupting into grumpy little explosions whenever I got within a few feet of him. My cheap ruse the night before had evidently been effective. That night was the second of two sold-out shows at Carnegie Hall, and I had been looking forward to it, if only because I'd be able to tell people I'd appeared at Carnegie Hall. I wasn't planning to mention that my climactic moment was having shaving cream sprayed down the inside of my jeans during an especially rowdy number. My rival had finally trundled off to her groovy Greenwich abode, and Frank and I had spent the morning consuming room-service bagels and grapefruit juice and listening to a record of an avant-garde work for solo harpsichord by Anthony Newman. Frank thought it was great, while I loudly opined that it was just so much florid poot. This apostasy sent him into a fit of harumphing and fulminating about my youth, cowboy damage, and general lack of musical savvy. As he sat on the sofa, with that half-sardonic, half-pedantic expression, and his wild black hair sticking out all over the place, he looked like a prisoner in some 16th-century Florentine dungeon, stuck in there for insisting that the moon orbited the sun. I could see that his feelings were hurt, and I didn't know whether to laugh or to feel sorry for him. I sat down next to him and gave him a hug. He kept on harumphing, but he also started to stick his hand in my shirt. Then the phone rang again. Later, I was in the bathroom brushing my teeth, having left him straightening up the living room. Frank, as I'd been learning, wasn't just tidy. He was that most dreaded of domestic monsters, the obsessive, compulsive organizer. There had better be a place for everything and everything in its place, because if he went to find that particular little Rintun Fremen he was looking for and couldn't, it was your fault, and you never hear the end of it. I didn't realize why he was like that until he happened to tell an interviewer that when he was growing up, his mother had always kept the hardwood floors in their house so highly polished you could see your reflection in them. I found this revelation truly frightening. As I was picking up the bottle of mouthwash, I heard the rattle of flipping pages, then an angry thump. "Nigel, come here." That was an order. I'd never heard him sound like that before. I sashayed into the living room and was confronted with the sight of him, mustache fairly bristling with outrage, my journal clutched in his fist. He'd seen my little notebook sticking out of my carry-on flight bag, and I guess the temptation to read about himself was just too much for him to resist. "What are you doing with that?" I asked, in the same sort of inarticulate rage I'd experienced when I was 12, and my father, snooping around in my room, had found a mildly smutty poem I'd written, which he claimed disgusted him. "That's not the point," Frank snapped. "The point is, are you going to run out and sell this stuff to Rolling Stone?" It was true, I'd been keeping detailed notes on the goings-on during the tour. I'd started my journal about the time I discovered Freakout, and as both entertainment and cheap therapy, it had gotten me through the misery of high school, my grandmother's illness and death, and a lot of other things. Like the old Russian fairy tale about Tsar Trajan having goat's ears, my journal was the only place I could set down the whole truth and nothing but the truth as I saw it, without worrying about what anybody was going to think. Frank should have understood that, and in fact, he probably would have if I hadn't been writing about my life on the road with him. For some reason, he had developed an absolute paranoia about journalists and being written about in general, grimly envisioning elaborate conspiracies by the press to disinform middle America about his life's work. It seemed odd to me that he had apparently forgotten how, on several occasions during the tour, I'd pointedly refused to talk to overly inquisitive rock journalists about him and our relationship. He knew that some of my writing on music, although nothing on him or his music, had been published, and I guess his paranoia had just taken over from there. When his buttons were pushed, Frank, usually rigorously logical, could take solipsism to unheard-of depths. The whole situation was highly ludicrous. For once, instead of Frank pointing out an inherent absurdity to me, it was the other way around. The rancid sock was definitely on the other foot, boys and girls. I tried to explain that my journal was my business, and guaranteed to stay that way, but he had gotten all lathered up and self-righteous, and it was no use. No matter what I said, I couldn't convince him that my journal entries weren't going to be the lead exposé in the next issue of Rolling Stone. If I'd been older and wiser, I would have realized that this was his way of venting his multitude of frustrations. But as it was, I wound up yelling at him and storming out of the Holiday Inn to lay Gotham to waste. It was the only power I had. Moments after hailing a cab in front of the Holiday Inn, it occurred to me I ought to look in my wallet. Ordinarily, I carried the necessities of life in an old brown tooled leather pouch on my belt, but it seemed suspiciously light all of a sudden. One quick, desperate glance inside was enough to confirm my worst fears. Sure enough, I'd stormed out and left my money behind in the suite. By this time, the cab had pulled away from the curb and was doing about 15 miles per hour as it entered the thick stream of traffic near Broadway. I let out a howl, seized the door handle, and leaped out. The cabbie was yelling something after me, but I didn't stick around to listen. Feeling like a cretin, I shambled back up Broadway. There was nothing to do but go up to the Holiday Inn and collect my errant billfold. I went around the corner, walked into the lobby, nodded to the doorman in what I hoped was an imperious manner, and took the elevator up to the 17th floor. The door to the suite was locked. I pulled out my key, unlocked it, and went in. I thought I remembered leaving my wallet on the dresser in the bedroom. As I walked into the living room, I noticed the suite was dark, and imagined Frank going around obsessively making sure all the lights were turned off before he left for Carnegie Hall to putter with the rented sound reinforcement gear. Knowing him, he'd be there scowling, twiddling knobs, and harumphing until some burly stagehand finally came and dragged him onto the stage for the show. Still castigating myself for my absent-mindedness, I started to walk into the bedroom. A strong whiff of obviously pricey perfume assailed my nose. There, in the gloom, beneath the sheet on the queen-size bed, was a writhing entity, a monster with two backs. I heard muffled moaning, rising in pitch. Another of Dr. Zircon's infernal experiments! After I'd wandered around, I found a deli, and was roundly insulted by the counterman during a semantic imbroglio about what constituted a plain cheeseburger. Replete, if a bit mystified by the folkways of Gotham, I came out on the street and glanced at my watch. By now, the vile Zircon would have completed his evil experiment and would be duly ensconced at Carnegie Hall. It was time for me to head back to the Holiday Inn and get some sleep. If he thought I was going to show up for the gig tonight, he was going to be very surprised. On the way back to the Holiday Inn, the cab passed Carnegie Hall. Dusk was falling fast, but I got a good look at the lineup stretching nearly around the block. Desperate mortals hoping to snag tickets for the sold-out show. Boy, the things I could tell them about their idol Frank Zappa. Every single last one of them, no matter how fanatic they had been, would promptly turn on their heel, march to the nearest League of Decency office, and put in a complaint. At the Holiday Inn, sure enough, there was nobody in the suite, just a faint vestige of old cigarette smoke and odious cologne in the bedroom. I climbed fully dressed into the unused bed and passed out. I woke up to the ringing of the phone. Squinting over at the little luminous travel alarm clock on the nightstand, I saw that the time was past 1 a.m. I didn't want to answer. It probably wasn't for me. But it kept ringing and ringing. Maybe it was Frank checking up on my whereabouts. Finally, I picked it up and mumbled, "Yeah." Click. I couldn't get back to sleep after that, so I went into the living room and chain-smoked the remaining cigarettes and a pack of Camels Frank had left lying around. It wasn't long before I heard a key in the lock. I slid down at one end of the sofa and crushed out the butt I'd been working on. Frank swept in alone, a fast fluid swirl of gruesome tweed, and set his guitar down. He came right over to me and, taking off his coat, threw it over the armchair. "Where were you?" he demanded. When he went into interrogation mode, he was intimidating as hell. Torquay Mada could have learned all sorts of things from Frank. I tried to think of him with his clothes off, hoping to reduce him conceptually to a ludicrous naked male, but it didn't work. Towering over me with those pitiless eyes drilling right through me, he simply refused to be a character in my movie. I decided I'd stay here and get some sleep, I replied. In my stomach, that damn cheeseburger was beginning to churn horribly. Was I about to become the spew queen of West 57th Street? Well, it was your show. I dedicated it to you. It's going on an album, too. Thanks, I guess. Actually, I had to stop and think about that. I'd never figured Frank for the sort of sentimental fool who'd get up in Carnegie Hall, no less, and make an idiot of himself publicly by mentioning names. Hadn't he savagely trashed that whole dedicatory syndrome on Reuben and the Jets? I finally heard the tape of the show more than a year later. He'd made a rambling, awkward sort of speech, explaining how he never dedicated shows to anyone, but this was a special circumstance, ladies and gentlemen. This show is dedicated to Nigel Lennon, who hitchhiked out here from California. Phew. I'd been getting worried there, but by turning the whole thing into an absurdity at the last minute, he just managed to save himself from coming across like the bandleader at the graduation dance at Antelope Valley Joint High School, 1958. And I'd like to send this slow one out to darling Mary Lou from her ever-loving Chewy. What he really meant, of course, was, who rode my face out here from California? Turned out there was a reason for this public spectacle, too. He frowned. We better talk. About what? I asked, trying to sound indifferent. I knew I couldn't fool Frank, but I'd be damned if I was going to let him see how awful I felt. Look, I know you're upset, he said, softening a little when he saw my pathetic attempt at coolness. Then he explained that one of the guys in the band had called Mrs. Zappa and told all sorts of lurid tales about our little road romance. Frank knew it was a bald attempt to get me kicked off the tour, but under the circumstances he had no choice. Clearing his throat, he said, in the morning we're going on to Toronto. I think you should go back to L.A. But, he cleared his throat, stalling for time, I thought. I've been watching you go through changes over some of this stuff, and I don't want to keep putting you through that. Do you understand? Sure, I understand. You're tired of me and want to get rid of me. You've gotten whatever you wanted, and now it's time for you to move on. Don't sweat it. I'll go. There's no point in my having any feelings on the subject. Frank took an inadvertent step backward and almost stumbled. From the look on his face, it seemed as if I'd suddenly breached the place where he kept his unbearable memories at bay behind rusted iron doors. Then, with an effort, he recovered, reached down and tugged me to my feet, pulling me close to him and holding me there. You don't understand. I care about you, but with you here all the time, there's just too much going on. It gets in the way of the things I have to do if I have to be thinking about you and worrying about you all the time. Geez. That sounded almost flattering. Was I that much of a distraction? I should have been angry, but I only felt sadness. Sadness unto death. If I could have managed to blurt out the truth that I loved him and wanted him to treat me like a human being with dignity and respect, I have no doubt he would have understood. He always wanted to hear that from me. But it was probably too late. Miss Moviola wasn't even part of the problem. The real problem was that I had no place in Frank's life, and I never would have. I hadn't wanted to think about this moment, although it had been inevitable from the beginning. Now it was here, and there was nothing I could say to forestall it. I just pressed my face against Frank's shirt and stood there in dumb agony, too hurt and too proud to speak. Frank held me close to him, his silence eloquent. There was nothing he could say either. Whatever the situation, it wasn't in his character to lie about it or even to soft-pedal it. My thoughts raced painfully. If he wasn't going to say something, maybe I had better. But what? Something? Anything? He'd blasted away my reserve, but the abyss remained an unbridgeable chasm. I was inundated with scenes from the previous 2 months. Airports, coffee shops, cars, buses, motel rooms, dark universe, billions and billions, enveloped, exploding, that voice, maybe we can get one together. I saw him on stage, masterfully controlling the band, but was that hand signal again? Let me know. I thought of Miss Moviola, of the mutant beast with two backs. That did it. With a blinding flash of light, Zircon's universe imploded, and all of a sudden I was standing in an antiseptic motel living room with an ugly brocade couch and a shag carpet, in the arms of a tall, gangly Italian guy who smelled like coffee and cigarettes and desperately needed a shave. Nothing. There wasn't a fucking thing I could say. In the morning, I rode to JFK on the band bus. I was full of raging emotions, despair, frustration, anger, but mostly I felt an aching sense of loss and injustice, as though I were being unfairly expelled from Utopia. Frank was plainly and visibly exhausted. He'd stayed up with me until almost 5 a.m. I'd finally fallen asleep with my head on his shoulder, cut off in mid-whimper by a snore. He woke me an hour or so later. Now he was all business, the road rat on fast forward. He had his suitcases and gear waiting by the door, and in very few words he told me to get packed. The bus was waiting downstairs, and everyone but us was on it. For the first time since I joined the tour, we didn't sit together. Looking like death warmed over, he deliberately took a seat by himself in the back of the bus. Miss Moviola had given him a parting gift, a smutty novel by Aleister Crowley. How very appropriate! I peered back at him. He was pretending to read it, but he wasn't turning the pages very fast. At the airport, I had to find a flight to LAX. I hadn't had time to make a reservation by phone. At least I had plenty of dough. Frank had settled up with me before leaving that morning, in cash. I couldn't help wondering where those brand new hundreds and fifties came from. As I stuck the wad in my wallet, it all seemed slightly sleazy to me, although the explanation wasn't anything more sinister than the fact that Frank, knowing I didn't have a checking account, had gotten the cash for me from Herbie or Dick. Frank and his band of merry men were bound for the international flight section. As they headed off in that direction, some of the guys were spiritedly bellowing a little ditty full of charming obscenities about the tits and ass and cheap thrills to be found just around the bend. It sounded pathologically cheerful in that dismal terminal, and there were gloomy glares from the gray commuters waiting for their grim flights to their bleak destinations in the freezing north. I had written a little farewell note to Frank, and I walked over and handed it to him. It said, F.C., I know you don't believe in love. Well, then, take mine and use it for vacuum cleaner bags or something. N.L. He tucked it into the back of the book, but didn't seem about to actually read it, at least not in front of me. I knew better than to expect anything as conventional as, Goodbye, it's been nice knowing you, from him. He'd bid me farewell in front of a sold-out house in Carnegie Hall last night, and then he kicked out my ass in private. What more did I want? Skywriting? What a fucking masochist I was. I forced myself not to hesitate. Without further ado, I turned and began to trudge resolutely toward the domestic flight counters. I had to physically struggle not to turn around and take one last look at him, but I managed to get around the corner without doing it.
Thank you very much, Nigel, and thou shalt be hearing more from Ms. Lennon on future episodes of the ZappaCast. Right now, we have some material from the only other concert performed in 1971 after the Montreux Fire event. This is the legendary, equally legendary show from the Rainbow Theatre in London on December 10th of 1971. It's actually a very interesting show for several reasons. One of those reasons is that the band are playing on borrowed equipment, having lost all of their equipment in the fire in Montreux. What we're going to give you here is a little bit of the end of the audience tape that exists of the show. Unfortunately, the audience tape of that show is not great quality. It is also not complete. It does not include the big historic event that happened at that show, of course, historically relevant event, that is, which is that Frank was pushed off the stage by a somewhat psychotic fan, non-fan, whatever you want to describe the guy as. But anyway, a deeply disturbed person shoved Frank off the stage, and he spent the better part of the next year in a wheelchair with several serious injuries. Now, what you're going to hear on this tape is King Kong, which is the last number that exists on the audience tape. Apparently, the band performed I Want to Hold Your Hand as an encore, according to Frank in the Real Frank Zappa book, before he was shoved off the stage. We don't have that, so right here on the ZappaCast, to just kind of tie this episode up, is King Kong from the Rainbow in London on December 10th, 1971.
Remember what happened last time we played this?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The ZappaCast was produced and edited by Scott Parker, Andrew Greenaway,
and Mick Eakers.
Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com. And if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers.
And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com.
If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at snet.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway
and Mick Eakers,
this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.